Welcome to the bookshelf. Tonight and tomorrow night, the stories from Pivot Spokane, delivered on February 8th under the topic Love Hurts. Tonight, three storytellers, Nicole Sheets and Suzanne McGuire with The Lighter Sides of Love, and Tony Flynn with The Decidedly Heavier Side of Love.
Please welcome Nicole Sheets.
It's the first day of the semester, and I see Chris in Spanish class. We're both students at a big state school back east. We'd met freshman year, but we'd lost touch. He was tall and gangly back then, and now he's filled out so much it takes me a moment to recognize him. It's the 90s. I wear my overalls and my flannel shirts and my Birkenstock clogs. When I need to get on the internet, I have time to read a magazine while I wait for web pages to load on my roommate's PC. I'm basically partying like it's 1999, if by partying you mean writing papers on Victorian poetry, or trying to master the subjunctive in Spanish, or leading a Bible study on campus, or passing out a gospel tract called The Four Spiritual Laws, which begin with Law 1, God has a wonderful plan for your life. In the 90s, in college, I'm deeply involved with Campus Crusade for Christ, an interdenominational Christian organization. And for much of my college career, that group is at the center of my social and spiritual life. So I invite Chris to one of our Friday night weekly meetings called Prime Time. We meet in an auditorium in a science building on campus. The praise band strums a few songs. The lyrics are shown on an overhead projector. And every week, one of the members of our group will give their testimony. The testimony is a streamlined version of the story of how you came to know Jesus Christ as your personal savior and the difference he has made in your life. Some testimonies are pretty dramatic. Say if Jesus has helped you overcome some sort of addiction. One woman in our group had a ruptured appendix that was misdiagnosed for 2 weeks. She almost died, and as she recovered, she began to visit area churches to tell the story of how God had saved her life. I told Chris he should give his testimony. It would be such a powerful story, I say. Chris has hemophilia, and he's HIV positive from some plasma that he got in the 80s before blood was screened for the virus. I have no idea how insensitive, how naive and presumptuous I am to keep pushing this idea. What do I, in my healthy body, know about blood disorders? What do I know about HIV, really? I know Magic Johnson has it, and he's okay. I know whatever I remember from high school health class, a class, let's be honest, that was mostly a series of VHS movies, always shown by a coach. We watched Philadelphia, where Tom Hanks plays an HIV-positive lawyer who's wrongly fired from his practice. We watched this movie called Something to Live For, in which the Molly Ringwald character gets HIV from a one-night stand. I am perversely starstruck by Chris's story. I can imagine it being made into a video to show to youth groups. I can see the movie poster. Chris has a sporty red car. He picks me up for hikes. We go to Cooper's Rock. Our college town doesn't get many movies, so sometimes we drive the 30 or so miles to Friendsville, Maryland, where we have more options. One evening, we decide that we're going to go see Amistad, the Steven Spielberg movie about the mutiny on the slave ship. You remember this one? It's maybe not an obvious choice for a date night. But this isn't a date, is it? In the 90s, a book called I Kiss Dating Goodbye is making the rounds among evangelicals. But even before that, I'd absorbed the idea that casual dating could be hazardous to one's spiritual health, right? I knew that I shouldn't date someone I couldn't marry, and I can't marry someone who doesn't share my faith. And the conversation is always about dating, right? Not sex, right? In Crusade, the question we talk about is not how far can you go with your boyfriend or girlfriend, but how pure can you be? right? How can you encourage your boyfriend or girlfriend to wait for God's wonderful plan? Most of the Crusade staff on our campus are married couples, and there's one couple in particular that loves to tell the story about how they never even kissed until their wedding. That was how serious they were about saving themselves for marriage. Honestly, our whole group was like the CrossFit of sexual purity. So Chris and I, we head to Friendsville, and it's snowing a little bit, but once we cross the state line into Maryland, it is really coming down. It's just a whiteout. We decide to turn back. Chris is very calm, but on the slow, slow drive, he's white-knuckling it back down Cheap Mountain. We get to town okay. He drops me off at my house. A little while later, I plug the cord into the wall jack and wait for my email. There's a message from Chris. In this message, he tells me he's afraid that he'll be the world's oldest virgin. He's afraid that he will never find a girlfriend. Chris tells me that sometimes he goes for long stretches when no one hugs him, no one even touches him. I realize that I never touch him. I never hug him after a fun day together. I never give him a kiss on the cheek at the end of a fun night. And the thing is that I want a boyfriend. I like hugs. I even think about sex sometimes. I share the evangelical young person's great fear: what if Jesus comes back before my wedding night? I mean, Christians are supposed to long for Jesus to come back and fix our broken world. It is supposed to be heaven on earth. But if you could have that after, say, a wild night at the Best Western, wouldn't that also be a wonderful plan? Looking back, I don't know really what I wanted from Chris. I was so afraid of doing something wrong with my body that it was easier just to keep everyone at a distance. Even Chris. Chris, who has these huge blue eyes and a sweet boyish face and a wonderful sense of humor, and the everlasting patience to endure my many comments about his awesome testimony. And I don't know what Chris wanted from me. Maybe he was happy to be friends. Maybe he was waiting for a flicker of encouragement before he made a bold move. Maybe he realized that bold moves would have been wasted on someone like me. But sometimes I wonder, what if it hadn't snowed that night? What if we'd made it to the theater in Friendsville? What if I'd occupied that armrest just right so our elbows had to touch? What if I had let my hand dangle there in the dark? Would he have taken it?
First storyteller this evening, Nicole Sheets.
Our next storyteller is, she's an acting teacher, she's a counselor, she's from Lewis and Clark High School. She's gonna tell you a story about the sartorial power and danger of always dressing to impress. Please welcome Suzanne McGuire.
Ours was a whirlwind romance. My roommates grew very weary of my crushes and just wanted me, for the love of God, to date someone who didn't know anything about theater. So they introduced me to a hotshot. That's actually a real job title, in case you didn't know that. A hotshot is a forest firefighter who's on the front lines of the fires, and it just so happened that this particular hotshot was also very hot. And he really was a hotshot. He had been in the Navy on a nuclear submarine. He chose to go to college and stretch himself by becoming a cheerleader at our college. He happened to have the best music collection I had ever seen, and he had never in his life ever seen a musical. So, it was a really crazy summer romance because the fires were the worst they had ever been, including Yellowstone, which burned over 1.5 million acres, and he was fighting that fire for most of the summer. He would whisk back into town very briefly. They could only stay for about 48 hours, and then they'd have to be back out again for about 21 days, depending on the fire. And I would get these postcards, and they would smell like really, really gross barbecue. But I treasured them. And he carved our names into a tree with a chainsaw. It was a whirlwind. We met in July. By October, we decided to get married. And that April, we did. The following summer was an equally busy firefighting summer, and he again was working on the fire line. This is how it would work. This was before cell phones. So, kids, imagine. There was no way of knowing when he was coming or going. One morning, I woke up and I just had this really strong feeling that he was coming back that day. He'd been gone for about 2 weeks. I didn't know where, somewhere rocky in Idaho, where the worst fires are. And I just knew, I got my postcards. And I woke up in the morning and I thought, I think he's coming home today. He had bought me, again, hot. He had bought me this beautiful white linen sundress for my birthday. And I thought, I'm gonna put on the sundress and I'm just gonna hope that he comes home. And then I thought, and you need to understand, this is a little unusual for me, a little like Nicole. And I thought, I could wear my bridal lingerie underneath. And so I did. And I don't do stuff like that. So I go to work. I have on my beautiful white sundress. Just remember, this was a few children ago. And I have my beautiful white sundress on and my bustier with my garters and my thigh-high stockings. And then I have to go to the dentist. And I'm running a little late. And so zip into my little Datsun B210. Some of you might have to look that up. Zip into my little, and I kind of rush out of the hotel where I worked, and I'm turning left, and suddenly I see in the very cloudy, misty day, a gray Suburban coming at me. And then I woke up. And I look in the rearview mirror, and I see blood all over my face, and I look down, and my really pretty white dress is splattered. And there's glass everywhere. And simultaneously, I am both grateful to be alive and feel my legs because the side of the car was pushed about to the middle of the steering wheel. Simultaneously realizing I have on my bridal undergarments. So, are going through my mind, including, I don't know where my husband is, there's blood, there's a car, it's really what happened. Unbeknownst to me, an hour before this happened, my husband had arrived back into town and was in the shower because he was planning to come to my work and surprise me. He was in the shower when the phone call came. He got out of the shower, knowing the phone had rung, listened to the answering machine. I'm looking at some of my students back here. Listening to the answering machine, hearing my manager explain that there was a very serious accident and he needed to get down there right away if he was in town. You have to understand that the off-ramp where he was coming from exactly faced the side of the car, which was completely smashed in. Again, no cell phone, no way to tell him I was okay, so all he could see was the car. He literally got there as they were putting me into the ambulance. I was pretty hysterical at this point, and I'm just embarrassed to admit that it literally was only because I couldn't figure out how to tell someone how embarrassed I was, and I didn't know what anyone had seen, and I didn't know what was happening with my undergarments and my dress, because I was taped to a board. I didn't know how I was taped. I didn't know where the dress was. It's all I could think about. He got there. We got to the emergency room. It escalated just a little bit when the nurse came in and said, "Honey, we're gonna have to cut that dress off." Not my beautiful dress. Oh my gosh, the underwear. Not my beautiful dress. She said, "Sweetie, you don't want that dress anymore." And my husband said, "I will get you another dress." And I finally had to say, "You don't understand what I'm wearing under the dress. And I was trying to surprise you." And it was a little interesting to me that every first responder that was on the scene of that particular accident visited the emergency room to make sure that I was okay. At any rate, sometimes love does hurt, but sometimes you get to celebrate. And my wonderful husband, Richard, and I look back on that memory with gratitude and with celebration. And as we, in two more months, celebrate our 29th wedding anniversary, I have decided that I could maybe wear something special, but I think we'll just stay home.
The second of our storytellers, Suzanne McGuire.
So the next speaker is going to be Tony Flynn. He hosts a show called Men in Charge. And what I like about the story that he's telling is it reverses that a little bit. It's not about being in charge. It's about feeling, in times you feel entirely helpless. It takes the comedy mask and turns it into the tragedy mask and then removes the mask altogether. And it's just his face. Tony Flynn.
Before I start, I naturally have to introduce a little vocabulary. You may or may not know the term contronym, but that refers to words that have divided or opposing definitions, like cleave and sanction and dust. I'm going to be suggesting in my little account that love is a contronym, and I hope we'll find out why, and I want you to remember this. I will be asking people in the third row in particular. Okay, it starts back in 1969. I was a kid. I got terrible news. Star Trek was canceled. It was over. There would never be Star Trek again. It was a terrible lesson for me to learn, but I did learn it. I learned that everything we love will be taken away from us. And throughout my entire long life, as the fabulous hair shows, I have learned about love in other ways. I've learned, for example, how relationships go south. There are usually three ways. No, there are only three ways. You get dumped, or you are the evil dumper yourself, or the third one, which is my least favorite, one of you dies. Now, you see how the tone changes as I go along. Okay, well, going to rush back in time to the early 90s. My wife at the time, and we know what wife at the time means. Sorry. Anyway, my wife was trying to enlarge our cultural scope, and she had heard about this new concert series called Zephyr, led by a young woman named Kendall Feeney. And she really wanted us to go. It was going to be difficult, challenging, atonal, arrhythmic music. Very challenging, like life itself. I didn't want to go because it was a Star Trek night. But I went along, and it changed my life. I sat back in the seat and was very glad when I did, because as Kendall walked out on stage, I was started to get the vapors. I had never seen such a magnetic, gazelle-like, elf-like, magical figure move before. I felt like, you know, the melted clock in the Salvador Dali painting? That was me. I was glad I was sitting down. And then when she spoke, her voice reminded me of champagne and strawberries, but the good champagne, over $15. And not factory strawberries, but the good kind that you steal from your neighbor's garden. That was what it was like. And then when she played, it was so fluid, so elegant, that I felt myself lifted up a bit from my Bing seat. And I, as well as hundreds of other men that night, decided we were really interested in difficult, atonal, arrhythmic, challenging 20th century music. And we went again and again and were captivated and learned a great deal. Years passed. I ended up getting an F in marriage and got divorced, and I sort of, well, essentially felt like an ambulatory armpit. I was in an emotional swamp. I was of no particular use to me or anyone. And then about a month after my term in the sewer began, I got this call from Kendall, whom I didn't know she knew me. I think she knew who I was because I taught at Eastern as well. And she said that she was starting developing a concert on the music inspired by Oscar Wilde, and she'd heard that I was an Oscar Wilde expert and I could be a valuable resource. And I wasn't and am not an Oscar Wilde resource, but I consented to her belief. I did not want to shatter her world, and so we did. We worked on it. And as time passed in development and then afterward, I got the strange, unsettling feeling that she liked me. And that made no sense to me, but she did. And I eventually got up the nerve to find out explicitly, and yes. And so I began spending the night at her house. Not on the couch, but upstairs. And then she would make me these huge breakfasts in the morning with many, many fried things and granola and 9 liquids, kefir, coffee and tea, a different flavor of kefir, milk. And our lives went on. We got married. We were unreasonably, stupidly happy. And I mean stupidly. After a few years, I was diagnosed with cancer. And I thought, damn. But then, after a year of horror and her wonderful support and caring, I just felt this terrible relief. I said, I got cancer. The worst that can happen has happened. We're okay. Here we are. We've learned things. We're better people. And then a couple years later, Kendall was diagnosed with cancer. Except hers was much more cancery cancer than my cancer. Her cancer was bad. Like, really, a couple of surgeries, 2 years recovery, unpleasant treatments. You can picture it. Everybody here has had cancer or knows somebody who has. It's not new. But we were not enjoying the second bout. It wasn't fair. Because I had earlier thought that life wasn't fair because I was a worm, the universe said I was a worm, and the universe said, because you're a worm and life isn't fair, we're going to reward you with Kendall. So I thought, okay, that's how the universe works, but not. She recovered, and we went back to what we did, playing and working and playing. I showed her how to play racquetball, because I'd been playing it for a number of years. I showed her a lot, and in 6 months she was better than I was, because she moved like the fine end of a whip. And also, I was distracted because of the way she so exquisitely occupied her snug workout clothes. But this was in our recovery time, and pretty soon, though, I noticed that I was starting to win again because she was having trouble catching her breath. And also, she wasn't occupying her clothes as thoroughly as she had before. And we went in and found out, oh yes, stage 4, everywhere. We found this to be disappointing news. And we kept going, sought some treatment, got her an extra year of life when she could still work and play, but something had really changed in how she was and how she conducted herself. Because early in our time together, those of you who know her know that she was a pretty anxious person. She was part wood nymph, part lit fuse. And at night, what she would do was she would thrash around a night before a concert, and which would keep me awake, which annoyed her because she said that kept her awake. But one thing she would do after a concert, I discovered this the first night early on, but she would, I was woken up one time when I felt her fingers on my back, you know, doing this, tapping. And I said, what? What's that? What? Should I get up? Is there a noise downstairs? And she said, no, don't move. Shh, I'm going over the measures that I missed last night. It was the weirdest kind of intimacy. I was there and not there. But anyway, we were past this, and she had slowed down, and she had an undiagnosed hip fracture, but still walked from her car to her office where she taught. And then that slowed down. And then it stopped. And then I was helping her up and downstairs, and then she was just downstairs. And then, I told you about the tone, right? Up and down. Okay, but anyway, 11 months and 4 days ago, I couldn't quite communicate with her. Her eyes had gone that gray, like the dinners that I'd made her, and that she had such small portions of, and hence was very slender. But they knew there was time to take her to hospice. Couldn't connect. And so we brought her in like lately delivered groceries to that wonderful spot. It is a wonderful spot. Don't go there unless you have to. But there was the usual catheter wrestle. And then her face changed. It looked as if her face had been forced into a funnel. And she began what I found later was called agonal breathing. It sounded like this. Like her body had become this mere hooting instrument of atonal air. And I learned that's when the signals for oxygen aren't going into the brain anymore. And it's the body just doing its So I stayed with her overnight, 36 hours, pretty much exactly. And then the agonal breathing slowed down. And then it stopped. And that was that. And I said what we all say, what we all would say, that's that. She is gone, and she is gone. except you remember way back when I told you about love being a contronym? As we all know without me telling you, love includes both absence and presence, possession and dispossession. And we all remember what Faulkner said about the past, right? He said, the past is never past. It isn't even past. And Kendall's gone. And what's ahead of us is that cold, bright void we like to call the future. But because she's in the marrow of my bones, she is stuck coming along with me. Thank you.
Tony Flynn, concluding part one of Pivot Spokane's February 8th program, Love Hurts. Previously, we heard from Nicole Sheets and Suzanne McGuire. Tomorrow night, we conclude with Paige Powers, Sam Joseph, and Harry Neff. You can hear these stories again as podcasts at kpbx.org or SpokanePublicRadio.org. My thanks to Pivot Spokane.